We'll be the very model of a modern network TV show. Each time that we walk into this august and famous studio, we're starting out from scratch after a run of 20 years. And so we hope that you don't mind that our producer was not doing well.
We hope that you don't mind that their producer was not doing well. We hope that you don't mind that their producer was not doing well.
Welcome to Michael and Us. I'm Will Sloan. Luke Savage is with me. Listen, I'm not. I just have to say, Luke and I have just been watching Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip for an upcoming episode.
A little teaser for you all.
Yeah, it's like we're just. I don't know.
I'm vibrating.
I'm just having such a good time. Like I've never really been into The West Wing. I've never watched it seriously or ironically, except for this podcast.
Unlike me, for whom it's my favorite show.
But I have seen all of Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip and revisiting it now, like, oh,
we were actually going to record on it today, but we realized very quickly, like, this is such a rich text, like, we might just watch all of it. If we just made Michael and Us about Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip for the next month and covered every episode, I'd be okay with that.
I mean, we just saw folks, you know, fans of Studio 60, us in the Studio 60 community will know what I'm talking about when I say that we have Gilbert and Sullivan in our heads right now.
Oh my God.
We'll be the very model of a modern network TV show.
So I'd never, like, I am a card-carrying credentialed Sorkinologist, okay? But I've never seen Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip. So as soon as it started, I kind of couldn't believe that I was actually seeing it. Like, it only exists in myth to me. And watching it felt very strange and uncanny. It was like watching something that was a memory of a past life. I feel like I've seen it, even though I haven't.
It is kind of awesome just watching it again, where it has this swagger to it in the early episodes of, like, this is the next big show. Like, every moment has that weight. Every character introduction has meet the new Jed Bartlett. Yeah. Well, anyway, we'll talk about it in more detail later.
More to come.
So, quite a week, huh? Tough week.
Yeah, we've got a big movie to discuss on this episode. It's one that our superdelegates, that is those who subscribe to patreon.com/Michael and Us at the superdelegate tier for $10 a month, they get to nominate a film once a month and vote on a film for us to discuss. And this month, they chose Passion of the Christ, which was a good choice. Although, yeah, it has nothing to do with anything that's going on in the world right now.
Well, expect to be persecuted for your beliefs, just like Christ was. There's my tenuous link.
That's right. People who exhibit decency and compassion, they're always hectored by extremists from both sides.
That's right.
Well, did you watch the White House Correspondents' Dinner?
No.
I watched it.
Oh my God. I'm actually surprised to hear that. You're a glutton for punishment.
Well, it was, I was trying to watch the Leafs game and it was not going well. My friend Mitch was here and, you know, Madeline was kind of watching it on her phone. And at a certain point, it's like, okay, the Leafs are not going to win. So let's flip over to the White House Correspondents' Dinner. So, I mean, I can't say I watched all of it, but I mean, I saw the big stuff. I saw, you know, Colin Jost. I saw Biden, who apparently, this was the shortest address ever delivered by a president at one of these. Can't imagine why.
I mean, a sick spectacle any year, but this year, good God.
Honestly, one of the most nauseating things I've ever seen. I mean, you know, we're basically preaching to the converted. If you're listening to this, I'm sure you already agree.
100 journalists dead in Gaza.
Yeah, and I mean, even without that, the White House Correspondents' Dinner has always sucked. Its premise is entirely fraudulent. It's like, the Fourth Estate, bold and intrepid, you know, it always keeps the bastards in power to account. But, you know, for one evening every year, we can all get together and have a big fancy night where we, you know, toast democracy and freedom of speech and the press. And of course, that's a very nice idea, but it's, you know, it's not what your average White House correspondent does. And what the White House Correspondents' Dinner really underscores and what it really feels like is a meeting at court. Like, from start to finish, this basically felt like a Biden campaign event. And that's not an accident, because particularly with the specter of Trump looming over everything, the people in this room, basically, whatever their nominal self-conception as bold truth tellers, they basically think like they work for the president, or, you know, in this case.
I mean, I don't have anything clever to say except the obvious, which is, you know, two nights later when the police are cracking down on the Columbia encampment, the journalism students are like locked in the Pulitzer building, told they can't leave or they'll be arrested.
There are snipers on the rooftops of American universities invited by the deans and pointed at the students of those universities. It's insane.
Anderson Cooper's on CNN spreading conspiracy theories about outside agitators while the Columbia radio station run by children,
man,
basically,
I
are doing good reporting.
I tuned into it last night for a few minutes. Absolutely incredible. Yeah. Those guys should win a prize. Yeah. Fuck the White House Correspondents' Dinner. And, you know, watching Colin Jost, I mean, I could not believe. I mean, so first of all, the joke's not funny. And I was actually pleased to see the New York Times panned his performance the next day, which I can't remember who it was, said on Twitter. Like, imagine you're Colin Jost and you've debased yourself for this shitty, awful president in this particularly horrendous moment of his presidency. You've just blown smoke up his ass. And then having done all that, the New York Times, the people you're trying to impress, they don't even like your jokes. Even to them, your jokes fall flat. And I have to say, watching it, I was really struck by, it didn't feel like it was going over that well in the room. The energy in the room, and like, I don't know, this was just my impression. I'm not sure what other people thought, but the jokes were kind of falling flat. The vibes were off. I like to think that the protests outside made a lot of people feel guilty to be there and kind of under mind like the normally like chirpy aura that surrounds something like this.
Or if not guilty, contributed to an impression that, wait, this is the prestige place to be. Like, something's not working here. I should look good here.
That's
right. Why am I not looking and feeling good here?
So yeah, Colin Jost just up there giving like one of the smuggest, most obsequious performances.
I mean, I get that he is an old like Pete Buttigieg friend, you know,
you said he was his Pete Buttigieg's roommate.
They were dorm mates, it turns out. So dorm mates at Harvard. So I get that he's not one of us, but he is a youngish comedy guy.
Like, I want to say, buddy, you know, you don't have to do this. The fact that he's chosen to do it, like, says something.
But like you're
like, he's not just a shitty lib comedian. Like, he's a bad guy.
You're a comedy guy who is not a million years old. So, like, wouldn't you know better than to do this? Why not be like one of those comedians who goes to the White House Correspondents' Dinner and like roast the thing, you know, do a Colbert or a Michelle Wolf.
And that, you know, those incidents, right, that's the tell about how fraudulent the premise of the White House Correspondents' Dinner is, because the rare time somebody's even stepped like one scintilla over the line into like anything approaching actual satire or criticism, people are disgusted. Yeah. How dare you?
Yeah. I mean, I guess Colin Jost, you know, likes the people in the room and wants to be liked by the people in the room. But I don't know, if you're a comedian, wouldn't you rather be the guy who goes viral? Wouldn't you rather become the folk hero who told off the assholes and the elites at the Correspondents' Dinner?
Yeah, you should check out a little show called Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip. Yeah. where they make bold
we used to have comedy.
yeah
this studio, the tradition in this studio, you know, the Smothers Brothers used to sit here.
Anyway, yeah, needless to say, fuck the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Absolutely awful. And then, of course, a few days later, I mean, recording this on May the 1st, happy May Day, by the way. I guess the Passion of the Christ is our May Day episode. Sorry about that. But, you know, this is less than 24 hours after police moved on the encampment at Columbia. And again, you know, I don't have too much to say about this. I think if you're listening to this, we're probably on the same page. But I did just want to read a little bit from a write-up by Jack Murray Perkinson in The Nation. This was published this morning. It's called This Is How Power Protects Itself. And he writes, "This shock and awe campaign was about smashing a rapidly expanding student movement whose bravery has captivated people around the world. It was about eliminating the threat that the pro-Palestine movement poses to business as usual. And it was about reminding these students, these kids who had the nerve to sit in tents, of who is in charge and who isn't. The students at Columbia and City College and UCLA and the University of South Florida and all of the more than 70 Gaza Solidarity protests that have emerged as campuses around the country committed the sin of believing that it is acceptable for them to try to influence what happens at their school, or heaven forbid, what happens in the world at large. The hope is that these protesters will learn who the world is really supposed to work for, that there is a sky-high price to be paid for questioning the natural order of things. You can feel the question thrumming through the violence and repression. How dare you? But here's the lesson in all this. The people in charge are scared. They are terrified of the power of the movement for Palestine, of its size, moral righteousness, fearlessness, diversity, and love. And they are terrified that one of the key pillars of the American system, support for Israel, no matter what it does, is being shaken." So we'll link to that. People can read the whole piece. But this gets me to the only real point I have to make here. I think many of us are rightly skeptical, if not downright contemptuous, of the tendency in certain quarters of the media to place so much stock in what happens on university campuses, particularly the campuses of Ivy League and elite institutions. I think that contempt is completely justified. It's absolutely ridiculous to read, you know, 50-year-old New York Times columnists who find what, you know, 18-year-olds are doing and saying on a campus like Yale or Princeton traumatic, so traumatic they're building an entire identity around it, they're writing books about it. All of that is completely ridiculous. Having said that, there is a reason why a protest like this at a place like Columbia touches the nerve of a certain kind of commentator. That's because they understand that one of the major purposes of an institution like Harvard or Yale or Columbia is to train the next generation of American elites. And so when there is this kind of open defiance going on, open defiance of the established orthodoxy, open defiance of the adults, open defiance of the Biden administration, they see that as a threat, and they're absolutely right to. It is a threat. That's the only thing that explains the absurd hyperbole with which these protests have been framed and discussed. I mean, I saw last night David Frum actually had a tweet where he said, if you want to stop yourself from becoming Weimar, you have to enforce public order against the Reds and the Browns. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is where we're at. I have no idea if he actually, I mean, it's hard to believe that even David Frum would say something like that and mean it with 100% seriousness. But regardless, resorting to a sentiment like that, I mean, equating teenagers who are sitting on the lawns at college campuses in protest against the mass slaughter of their fellow human beings, equating that to the brown shirts is utterly beneath contempt. And the one positive thing you can say about it is the constant resorting to that kind of thing just shows how shaken these people are by what's going on.
I mean, we're talking about the Passion of the Christ on this episode.
Hell yeah.
a super delegate pick. And whenever we watch a movie, our minds turn to, well, what did Roger Ebert think of it? And maybe some of you listening are tired of our constant invocations of Roger Ebert. But the thing is, nobody is a better bellwether of or representative of a certain kind of mainstream opinion.
Yeah, Will's right. I mean, less people think that Roger Ebert is just like a character we're bringing in because we respectively have longstanding relationships with him and his work. I mean, that's part of it, but that's actually not the reason why we use him. Like, Ebert is, as Will says, a very important barometer of a certain kind of informed, received wisdom in the culture. And that's the main reason we talk about him so much.
And I think this was actually, it's not uncharitable to say that this was his project to be America's critic.
Uh-huh.
And that's why he called his books the great movies, not
the great movies,
not great movies, not my personal canon. He called it the great movies. So he gave The Passion of the Christ 4 stars. Okay.
Did he see it? One assumes.
He writes, and actually he does get at something in this review that I wouldn't say I agree with it, but I 20% agree with it.
Okay, hit me with it.
Because if there's one thing you can say for The Passion of the Christ, it is that it is true to its vision and uncompromising in it. It's limited, narrow, dark-hearted vision. And Ebert writes in his review, I prefer to evaluate a film on the basis of what it intends to do, not on what I think it should have done. So already I think he's conceding way too much ground there. But he continues, it is clear that Mel Gibson wanted to make graphic and inescapable the price that Jesus paid, as Christians believe, when he died for our sins. Later on he says, for we altar boys, this was not necessarily a deep spiritual experience. Christ suffered, Christ died, Christ rose again, we were redeemed. And let's hope we can get home in time to watch the Illinois basketball game on TV. What Gibson has provided for me, for the first time in my life, is a visceral idea of what the passion consisted of. That his film is superficial in terms of the surrounding message, that we only get a few passing references to the teachings of Jesus, is, I suppose, not the point. This is not a sermon or a homily, but a visualization of the central event in the Christian religion. Take it or leave it. So that's what Ebert says.
I think that's bad criticism.
Yes.
Like, Ebert as the critic should respect himself and his role a little more. The move he makes off the top there, saying, I evaluate films based on not what they should be doing or should have done, but on what they intend to do.
What if the project is flawed? What if the idea is bad?
Yeah, I mean, that's where I was going. I mean, he leaves himself with no resources henceforth, having issued that declaration. He leaves himself with nothing that allows him to actually ask fundamental questions about the film, whether it needed to exist, whether its project is a good one. And having just seen it for the first time, I have to tell you, I have none of Ebert's reservations. I'm willing to say this is a bad film. I'm not going to give it a star rating. I mean, if it has one, it would be one or maybe zero. But I have no reservations about saying that this is a bad movie that represents a bad project. And even on the basis of the narrower scope of critique he tees up there, this movie fails on its own terms. It is a badly executed version of the bad thing that it is trying to do. It sucks.
Before we get to the movie, and there is actually a lot to talk about.
Oh boy.
I think the star rating thing is funny. And Ebert has no shortage of defenders who will say, well, you know, he didn't even like giving star ratings. They were sort of imposed on him by the Chicago Sun-Times.
Yeah, we are all fallen creatures, you know?
To which I say, well, they certainly infected his thinking.
We're all sinners.
You know? And star ratings increasingly, you know, I have a Letterboxd account. There was a time, you know, 5 years ago when I would sometimes, you know, put a star rating on a movie. And I do that increasingly not at all anymore, unless it's like five. It feels ridiculous to look up, you know, you'll go and you'll see somebody's given Chimes at Midnight 4.5 stars. Even this movie, The Passion of the Christ, which to give it a star rating is very strange. Like you're gonna quantify this. Like, do you go to a gallery and you say, well, this Edvard Munch painting is 3.5 stars.
Well, here's this
Warhol is 2, you know? It's strange. It's so reductive.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. I mean, you were telling me that there's another review where he actually kind of lays out what the stars mean to him, what the metric is. And for him, it's a relative category. And maybe you can explain to people what that means. But to finish the thought, to me, if you're going to give things a rating, it only makes sense as an absolute category. I think fundamentally I'm on board with you here. I mean, I'm not sure I really believe in giving films stars. I mean, I've reviewed films many times. And for me, if a film is interesting enough to review in the first place, your job as the person reviewing it is to make qualitative judgments, value judgments about it, not quantitative ones where you're like, oh, it's this many bags of popcorn or whatever. I mean, I guess to be fair to old Roger Ebert, he did have to review films every single day, certainly every single week. And so obviously, and you know, he's doing it for a mainstream newspaper where a lot of people are reading the film reviews as kind of a, should I go see this? You know, it's kind of a, you know, consumer review. But to me, that just speaks to it being sort of instrumental in a profaning of the enterprise of criticism.
Well, this review, and this is one of my favorite Roger Ebert reviews. I should say it's one of the quintessential ones. It's one that I disagree with vigorously, but so much of his project is in here. In 2004, he reviewed the movie Shaolin Soccer. In fact, within weeks of his review of The Passion of the Christ, Shaolin Soccer, for those who don't know it, is a Hong Kong comedy. I think at this point, it's safe to call it a bit of a classic. I mean, I love Shaolin Soccer. I think it's a great film.
I haven't seen it, and not knowing anything about it except what Will has just said, I guarantee it's better than The Passion of the Christ.
Ebert gives it 3 stars, and he begins his review, Shaolin Soccer is like a poster boy for my theory of the star rating system. Every month or so, I get an anguished letter from a reader wanting to know how I could possibly have been so ignorant as to award 3 stars to, say, Hidalgo, while dismissing, say, Dogville with 2 stars. The disparity between my approval of kitsch and my rejection of angst reveals me, of course, as a superficial moron who will do anything to suck up to my readers. What these correspondents do not grasp is that to suck up to my demanding readers, I would do better to praise Dogville. It takes more nerve to praise pop entertainment. It's easy and safe to deliver pious praise of turgid deep thinking. It's true, I loved Anaconda and did not think The United States of Leland worked. Some dated movie references here,
yeah,
by the way.
Yeah, it just goes over my head.
But does that mean I drool at the keyboard and prefer man-eating snakes to suburban despair? Not at all. What it means is that the star rating system is relative, not absolute. When you ask a friend if Hellboy is any good, you're not asking if it's any good compared to Mystic River. You're asking if it's any good compared to The Punisher. And my answer would be, on a scale of 1 to 4, if Superman, 1978, is 4, then Hellboy is 3 and The Punisher is 2. In the same way, if American Beauty gets 4 stars, then Leland clocks in at about 2. And this is why Shaolin Soccer, a goofy Hong Kong action comedy, gets 3 stars. It is piffle, yes, but superior piffle. If you were even considering going to see a movie where the players zoom 50 feet into the air and rotate freely in violation of everything Newton held sacred, then you do not want to know if I thought it was as good as Lost in Translation. So, I mean, in this review, it's like it's kind of a phony populism that unthinkingly reinforces certain hierarchies of taste. And I love the examples he uses as like, well, 4 stars, that's obviously, you know, Mystic River, that's Lost in Translation, you know, the highest, the highest pinnacles of the cathedral of art, right? And Shaolin Soccer, which, folks, if you ask me, better than Mystic River, certainly better than The Passion of the Christ, I'll tell you that fucking much. But like The Passion of the Christ, I don't know, it's just interesting the benefit of the doubt that he'll give that. I mean, by his own logic, I don't know, I think Shaolin Soccer accomplishes what it sets out to do.
And I mean, what, you know, what is The Passion of the Christ? It's 4 stars relative to what? Pasolini? Pasolini's 4 stars. Yeah. This shit's 0 stars.
Yeah, yeah. So, but this is a movie, The Passion of the Christ is a movie that came marketed as an event, okay?
Right, so he just treats it as one.
That's right. That's right. Like, this is a movie, there was a drumbeat of publicity, a drumbeat of discourse for a whole year. And you kids listening who weren't there at the time won't know that in 2004, the election year of 2004.
Hell yeah. The most important election of our lifetimes.
A moment when temperatures were high. Unlike now, of course. Uh-huh. Unlike this election year. There were kind of twin movies that were these big cultural phenomena that had a year of discourse around them. On the left, you had Fahrenheit 9/11. On the right, you had The Passion of the Christ. Both movies that were scorned by Hollywood. You know, Disney famously dropped Fahrenheit 9/11. Harvey Weinstein distributed it himself. The Passion of the Christ, this is a movie that Mel Gibson, at the height of his power, one of the biggest stars in the frickin' world, spends $30 million of his own money to make the most realistic, the most uncompromising, the most brutal movie about the death of Christ. In late 2003, Frank Rich in the New York Times is already waging war on this movie, digging up unpleasant information about, let's call it the opinions of Mel Gibson's father. Certain things about Mel Gibson's life and thought are coming to light, to which Mel Gibson famously said of Frank Rich, I want to kill him. I want to kill his dog. I want his intestines on a stick. That's the kind of man we're dealing with here. You know, like, but the stakes felt so high in this movie. And so, yeah, it comes with this affect to it that somebody like Ebert.
Right. And we can put Ebert to bed in a minute, but I do think it's worth underscoring. And yeah, as you've said, you know, maybe reminding a few of our Zoomer listeners that, yeah, this was one of the biggest movies of 2004. I mean, I was aware of it, even though I was a teenager living mostly in rural Ontario at the time without regular access to TV, didn't really go to the movies. My parents did not see this movie. I knew all about it. It was much discussed. It was the kind of thing that was riffed on in, you know, South Park in multiple episodes. So yeah, it was everywhere. And yeah, here Roger Ebert comes along. It's, you know, I do appreciate the two reviews you read, the one in which he discusses the star rating system and the, you know, The Passion of the Christ, because I think, you know, if nothing else, at least Ebert was explicit about how he approaches this task of reviewing movies. So one, the ratings he gives them are relative rather than absolute. And two, when he watches something like The Passion of the Christ, he reviews it on the basis of what he thinks it's trying to do, not what it should be doing. And so once again, the mere fact that this film has lots of money behind it, that there's a big star behind it, that it has quite explicitly had a marketing campaign behind it that has teed it up, quite overtly teed it up to be, you know, cultural event of the year, trademark symbol, that is enough for Ebert to kind of take it seriously and to not ask any questions about whether the insane shit that Mel Gibson is trying to do is worth doing or is valuable at all.
So this movie is horrible. It sucks. I mean, it's awful. You know, as an old lapsed Catholic myself, I mean, there's nothing to enjoy or like or respect about this movie. But, you know, if I do have 2% of respect for this movie, I'm thinking of where Mel Gibson is coming from. And, you know, we saw the Diane Sawyer interview that he did, a huge primetime hour-long interview.
Batshit insane interview.
And we'll get into it later treats in that interview.
Jesus.
This interview aired on like ABC in prime time and 20 million people saw it. Okay.
Yeah. And it is
it should have ruined him.
The tone of it, like, it is as insane as that, you know, the famous interview with Tom Cruise that was like leaked.
Yes.
You know, where he's talking about Scientology. It is that, but on, you know, yeah, marquee prime time, you know, and it's Diane Sawyer asking him about his father's Holocaust denial and shit like that.
Yeah. But anyway, the interview starts with Gibson saying,
"He's wounded for our transgressions, and by his wounds, we're healed. That's the point of the film. It's not about pointing the fingers. It's not about playing the blame game. It's about faith, hope, love, and forgiveness. That's the reality for me. I believe that. I have to."
Disingenuous, I would say.
Yeah, should have put some forgiveness and love in it, asshole, if that's what it was about.
Ebert is correct that this movie is not about Christ's teachings. It's not about the political context that led to Christ's execution. It's not about context at all.
It is barely about Christianity.
It is single-mindedly. It is single-mindedly about Christ's suffering. And Ebert is right. Take it or leave it. And Gibson obviously wanted to focus on the magnitude of Christ's sacrifice, the magnitude of the suffering he endured, and how we all should be very grateful for that, because all this suffering was for us. He died for our sins. I actually don't think that idea comes across.
No.
I don't think he conveys exactly how this translates to him.
You need
dying.
To have it. No, because you need to have the stuff about Christ's teachings. You need to have the love and compassion and universalism in order for there to be stakes in this.
Well, I mean, what actually comes across, there are several moments in the movie where we do see bits of Christ's teaching, little flashbacks, and without exception in them, he's saying,
if you follow me, you will be persecuted. And this too, I really like, because like I said, this is barely a movie about Christianity, and it's not really a Christ biopic either. This is an autobiographical film. What's actually happening in those sequences is different parts of Gibson's psyche are talking to themselves and being like, look, if you make the Passion of the Christ, you will be persecuted, but it's okay. It's your ticket into the kingdom of heaven. This is how we wipe clean all those DUIs and the many future DUIs and the soliloquies that might accompany them to come.
Yeah, an unfortunate night in Malibu. No doubt about that. But also just thinking about where Gibson's head is at. Famously, he is a Catholic, but he rejects Vatican II. In fact, his father, Hutton, the late Hutton Gibson, RIP, died at the age of 100. So, you know, only the good die young. That's all I'll say about that. But Gibson himself and his father were members of a splinter sect. In fact, I think in a church that Gibson himself paid to have built that does not subscribe to Vatican II. You know, his father had said words to the effect of Pope John Paul II is the Antichrist or that sort of thing.
Part of the explanation one assumes for the fact that this film has no English in it, right? Like much of it's in Latin.
That's true.
Probably the most famous thing to come out of Vatican II was that, you know, the liturgy no longer had to be delivered in Latin.
And there are Catholics for whom that's a bone of contention. Antonin Scalia would drive like 90 minutes every Sunday to, you know, whatever the nearest Latin mass church was.
Right, so he could sit there and listen to a bunch of shit he didn't understand.
Yeah, it's beyond me. I don't get it. But in that Diane Sawyer interview, she asks him, you know, many biblical scholars think that a lot of the stories are metaphors or they're exaggerated or they're, you know, using poetic symbolism or this or that. Do you believe them all literally?
Do you have a literal belief of the Bible, every sentence in it?
Yes. Yes, you either accept the whole thing or don't accept it at all.
Now, obviously, I do not subscribe to that belief. The Catholic Church does not subscribe to that belief. But I take this movie to be a sort of metaphor against cafeteria Catholicism, basically. This is what Mel Gibson thinks faith is. He's looking at you and he's saying, all you Catholics out there think that you can have a second Vatican Council that makes things easier.
You think you can listen to a fucking sermon in English,
yeah. You know? Yeah, faith is about sacrifice. Faith is about self-abnegation. Sometimes faith is about suffering.
Uh-huh, apparently, and watching movies, too, apparently, is about suffering.
Yeah, sometimes movies won't give you such niceties as...
Yeah, being entertained, having narrative structure...
Second idea.
Yeah.
A second idea would have been nice, I think you'll agree. And so to the extent that I have any respect for this movie, it is in that. And I'm saying that in the most qualified
way. With a giant smirk on your face. I hear you. Look, well, I both agree and disagree because this film did, in a way, do something for me. It scratched an itch that I've been feeling since we watched, we've on two recent episodes discussed installments of the wacky evangelical God's Not Dead series. Thanks again to friend of the show, Alex Shepard of the New Republic, for joining us on those. You can hear the latest one at patreon.com/Michael and Us. Those movies sure are a good time, but, something that I think was really hitting the three of us after watching the third one especially, I mean, the fourth one got more wacky, but, still is doing this thing where it's trying to kind of hedge. It's making these pragmatic concessions in the interests of broad appeal and box office returns. The people behind those films are committed ideologues, and yet they have to be like, oh, well, actually, school prayer helps everyone. It's not, a sectarian or a communitarian demand that we're, pressing on secular institutions. Actually, school prayer or teaching creationism in public schools or whatever, that's the real secularism. Right-wing evangelicals are the only tolerant people in America. He's doing all that kind of bullshit.
But a man who builds his own splinter sect is not interested in reaching across the aisle.
That's right.
This movie is much more in the lineage of something like If Footmen Tire You, What Will Horses Do?
Yes, I agree, but I only partly agree. The film did scratch this itch where, I watched the God's Not Dead movies and I thought, oh, can we just have some balls to the wall, wacky Christian stuff, please? Like, do you have to do this stuff? Do you have to shoehorn all these things in where you're telling the audience, oh yeah, we're not racist? It's like, yes, you are, And so this movie is, it's completely insane. I mean, Mel Gibson says he's a Catholic, but I mean, there's a certain point at which the insane kind of Catholicism to which he subscribes, this is the real horseshoe theory. It just converges on, the most insane right-wing evangelical stuff. So in that sense, it did kind of, scratch the itch for me. It was like, okay, yes, this movie feels like a high-budget version of an insane evangelical film where it does not care about narrative structure. There's, characters just sort of appear and then disappear, and they appear as if you're just supposed to know who they are and what their role in the story is. There's no exposition. There's just the same dumb idea, just, used like a crude instrument, beating you over the head over and over again. So it did all that. But where I disagree is, I think, Gibson is too much of a Hollywood guy. This movie is filled with all of these bullshit, musical cues. Right away, about 15 minutes in, there's a scene where, the evil rabbi counselor, whatever, throws Judas Iscariot a bag with the pieces of silver in it, and then for some reason, the bag flies through the air in bullet time. Why? This movie ends in what feels like about a 3-hour long, like a documentary length sequence of not just Christ's crucifixion, but him carrying the cross through the streets, all of it. And it seems to me, if Gibson was taking his own premise seriously, he would not have had any music here. He would have filmed this like a documentary. But no, it has to have all these heavy-handed musical cues to tell you how to feel, which is very much like the worst evangelical filmmaking you see. Like, no subtlety can be permitted. There can't be any subtext to anything, either in terms of what you're seeing on screen or as pertains to whatever, religious or spiritual message the film is conveying. Scripture is the most literal thing ever. Like, nothing is allowed to have subtext, symbolism, metaphor, anything. And that, to me, is where The Passion of the Christ not only fails as a film, I mean, it sucks, obviously, but it fails according to the narrower category of analysis that Ebert offers. It fails on its own terms for me.
Yeah, I mean, there's a standard line on Mel Gibson that, he's a wacky guy with strange views, but you got to hand it to him. He's a good filmmaker. He knows how to make a movie. To which I would say, actually, what if he's a bad filmmaker? Have you ever considered that?
What if he made, what, two good movies?
Apocalypto, yeah. I think you kind of maybe got to give him. Although after this, I'm starting to think maybe I should look at that one again.
I saw Braveheart once. I thought it sucked.
I think Hacksaw Ridge is a piece of shit. That's just my opinion. And this one is a painting of Christ on black velvet. It's exactly what you say. You know, so if I were making a movie like this, and I'm not, but just on a dramatic level, yeah, it would be interesting. You know, what are the political reasons for Christ's persecution? In this movie, it just shows a cabal, let's put it that way. some elders of Zion rounding him up, following certain protocols, I would say, persecuting Christ for the crime of being such a good person. And
which we basically never see him being a good person.
Well, there's a flashback where we see him make a table.
He makes a table.
And he's nice to his mother. And he shows you that flashback when he's being persecuted, as if to say, why would they round up this guy?
Yeah, the man made a table.
He's so nice. He's good to his mother. Hey, what's the problem? But yeah, you're right. It's like all of these tacky Hollywood touches. Like if the movie actually were just about its one idea and was fiercely committed to its one idea, then you might have something. But so the centerpiece scene of the film is Christ getting scourged, mm-hmm. which is one line in the Bible. But nevertheless, Gibson expands it to a 15-minute set piece, gruesomely violent, incredibly sadistic. And, you know, Christ having had literal muscle torn out of his back, okay, like a checkerboard of gore.
This scene, I should say, is quite disgusting.
It's awful.
I mean, it's really nasty.
So, you know, having had that done to him, he like stands up like an action hero and does this action hero pose. That's not a serious work of art. That's a work of art that fails on its own terms. Okay. Uh-huh. It's like, what if a wretched, racist, dark-hearted man.
Yeah, whose dad is literally a Holocaust denier.
What if that man could only communicate through kitsch? You know, whenever that generic Middle Eastern music plays, you know, like you think Arnold Schwarzenegger has to go save the embassy.
You know? Yes. This movie is both too weird, but it's also not weird enough. It's like, if you're going to make a dumbass weird movie, you have $30 million to turn your insane racist guy mind palace into a movie to market it as the cultural event of the year. Just fucking own it. He's too much of a Hollywood guy. Anyway, we should get into the actual, you know, plot of the movie, such as it is.
Yeah, and if you know the words, sing along.
That's right. Yeah,
have called it the greatest story ever told.
Yeah. We open with a title card. It's Isaiah 53. He took our pain. He bore our suffering. His punishment brought us peace. Now, I was not raised Catholic. I gather that's often read on Good Friday. In its original context, it was obviously speaking about Christ. I think maybe in this film, it's about Mel Gibson. Now, something that's probably of note here, just vis-a-vis mine and Will's respective reactions to this movie. I mean, I hadn't seen it and he saw it when it came out. But as Will's alluded to already, you know, he was raised Catholic. I was not raised as anything. I have, you know, one side of my family is, you know, Church of England. But, you know, I was not raised in a religious context at all, a thoroughly secular agnostic household. I did spend some time in church as a kid because I was in choir. But I mean, like, I never went to Bible study or anything like that. So my knowledge of even the most basic Christian stories is kind of rudimentary. Like it comes from reading St. Augustine very closely. You know, it comes from studying political theory, which suffice it to say is a rather unorthodox route. So I'm going into this movie relatively blind compared to Will. The film opens and it's like, okay, what are we doing here? When is this? Who are these people? I mean, obviously I have some familiarity with all this stuff, but for the first, you know, 15 minutes or so, like unless Will had told me, I would not have understood that, okay, this is, you know, there are things on the screen which indicate that this is just after, you know, hours after the Last Supper. You know, we're dealing with the late period Jesus, you know?
Yeah, he's making his Abbey Road.
That's right. He's falling out with the disciples. They're all, you know, they're all kind of going solo and doing their own little things, you know, Pauline Pam, you know, he's carrying that weight, folks, the weight of our sins. Zing! Now, I think my reaction to the film was partly informed by my relative ignorance compared to Will's. But also, this film is barely a film. It doesn't do any just basic film stuff to explain, like, what's going on. There isn't even a title card, you know, saying the year. There's nothing. There's no...
33 AD.
So you have no idea what's going on. Like, the film just takes as axiomatic, like, folks, you know all the backstory here. It's Jesus Christ. It's Jesus of Nazareth. You know him. You love him. We're not going to tell you what his teachings were, because you know those. You love those, too. So henceforth, everything you're going to see is just racism and torture porn.
So I'm no biblical scholar. I know some of the classic stories. I'll tell you what I know about Jesus. You know, he's born. King Herod hears that there was a Messiah somewhere who was born, so he orders all the firstborn in a certain radius killed. I always found that a little far-fetched, frankly. Nevertheless, 33 years later, we see him again. He's doing miracles. He's healing the sick. He's casting out devils. But then on top of that, he's got a whole system of ethics that he's developing. Love your neighbor like yourself. Turn the other cheek. All the hits. He's also a bit of an anti-imperialist, a bit of an anti-Roman zealot. This gets downplayed a little bit. I feel like some of those edges were probably sandpapered off the Bible a bit, you know, as they were trying to sell it in Rome. Nevertheless, things are going okay for the Son of Man until he starts getting a little big for his britches, you know? Fucks up the moneylenders at the temple. he rolls into town surrounded by his posse, all waving palms. The Romans and the rabbis look at him and they say, you're fucking around, now you're gonna find out.
Yeah, some Roman thugs show up at the beginning and they're like, yo, where's the Nazarene troublemaker? Yo, we're looking for Jesus of Nazareth. You got him here?
None of that context is in the movie. What we know from the movie is that
there's a Nazarene troublemaker and the authorities don't like him.
Yeah, and the authorities, I mean, you know, folks, just look up a picture of the authorities, and I think it speaks for itself. What you know is that the Council of Rabbis have him arrested, and, you know, they beat him up, they torture him a little bit. They take him to Pontius Pilate, you know, their imperial ruler, and they say, you gotta kill this guy. He's making life difficult for us. He's forming his own splinter sect. He says he's the king of the Jews, and that poses a problem for the cabal. And Pontius Pilate, who in this movie comes off as pretty affable.
He's like a centrist. The film is very clear that it's like, look, the Romans aren't the villains, okay? The Romans are just doing the bidding of the villains.
Yeah. There's a really great bit where Pilate, who's doing everything he can to not crucify Christ, says something like, oh my God, I have to deal with so many uprisings.
Yeah, he's having a pain conversation with Mrs. Pilate.
Who is fully in the tank for Jesus.
That's right.
She thinks he's divine. Yeah. But he says, you don't understand. Being a brutal imperial ruler is hard.
It's a polarized time. Yeah. You know, these are the conversations that Joe Biden is having with his wife.
So he tries to pawn Jesus off on King Herod down the street. And King Herod, here's the thing about Mel Gibson. He's heard what you've said about ancient Rome. He's heard that it was much more sexually liberated than now. He's heard all that Gore Vidal shit and he doesn't like it. Uh-huh. And so that is represented in the King Herod scene where King Herod is the swishiest, most cross-dressing, most makeup-wearing King Herod in film history. And he's surrounded by this, it's like a scene out of Caligula, for God's sake.
Yeah, you know what this actually reminded me of was, do you remember the scene in 300 when the sort of hunchback traitor who the Spartans won't let fight with them, and he goes to Xerxes' tent or whatever, and it's like, yeah, everyone in the tent is, you know, gender fluid or whatever. Like, it's basically meant to be like Tumblr or something. Like, that's what Herod court is like as well. Mel Gibson, important to emphasize, also a famously homophobic man. If you just look up Mel Gibson homophobia, you're going to find a lot of stuff.
Yeah, and we should also note that Satan appears in this movie as gender fluid, right? Like, am I wrong in saying that?
Well, Satan's played by a woman, in fact. Yeah.
But of ambiguous gender in the film.
Yeah, sort of androgynously depicted. And that's Gibson showing you that what he thinks of as demonic, which, you know, when I think of demonic, I just think of this movie, Mel Gibson, and the press tour he did to promote it.
Just a word on historical accuracy, too. I mean, the decision to have all the dialogue be Aramaic and Latin, I mean, that contrasts amusingly with just all the Hollywood touches of the film. I mean, late in the movie, Gibson, for example, invents this cathartic moment where the bad guy on the cross next to Jesus, you know, there's the good guy on his left, the bad guy on his right. Well, the bad guy gets a little crow on top of his head pecking out his eye. You know, just idiotic Hollywood flourishes like that. Again, he's a man with no taste. So like his idea of historical accuracy is just as simple-minded as, well, they should all be speaking Aramaic and the movie should have no narrative frills.
Right. And it shouldn't really be operating at any level of abstraction or symbolism either. This movie, as I've said, feels very much like a film made by a conservative Protestant evangelical because it has the most literal interpretation of scripture imaginable. It sees no kind of wider valence to the events it's depicting apart from the individual's literal suffering. Like, Christ's suffering has no kind of wider dimension to it because Christ's teachings aren't really, apart from where he says, yeah, if you're a Christian, you're going to be persecuted. If you follow me, you'll be persecuted. Because Christ's teachings are given no more substance than that, we have just the most crudely literal story imaginable. And here, you know, the film can, I think, reasonably be charged with making the same pragmatic concessions for broad appeal, if I can put it that way, as the God's Not Dead movies. Because, yeah, this is a Catholic movie, but it's clearly targeted towards American evangelicals, and it clearly worked on them. There was widespread evangelical support for this movie.
Well, Frank Rich, in those New York Times columns that earned Mel Gibson's ire, partly they were focused on what Mel Gibson's father was saying, but they were also alleging that Gibson had very consciously sort of stoked anti-Semitism throughout the year-long build-up to this movie by hosting all of these preview screenings for mostly evangelical groups, with a few, you know, token rabbis here and there, and propelling this narrative of, you know, Hollywood doesn't want me to make this movie. Hollywood doesn't want you to see this movie. I'm being persecuted for my beliefs, just like Jesus was in this movie, just like you are in real life, and the unspoken part being, and yeah, by the same group too.
Pat Robertson fucking loved this movie. Ted Haggard loved this movie. Jerry Falwell loved this movie. And yeah, it's not hard to see why, because theologically it feels very close to the kinds of sermons that guys like that preach.
I'm not sure where this fits in, by the way, but one of the many little micro controversies around the movie was in the Gospel of Matthew, during the crucifixion, someone in the crowd is quoted as saying, "His blood be on us and on our children," which, you know, it's the blood libel statement, you know. And in the film, it is apparently said in the film, but Mel Gibson relented to pressure to not subtitle it.
He wanted it to just be completely inscrutable.
In a New Yorker profile from 2003, it says, "Gibson yielded, but he has some regrets. I wanted it in," he says. "My brother said I was wimping out if I didn't include it. It happened. It was said. But man, if I included that in there, they'd be coming after me at my house. They'd come kill me." So that was in the New Yorker. That was in the New Yorker.
He mentions what his brother's comments on the film are. Did he canvass any other members of his family for thoughts on the film?
Also, you know, just returning to the Diane Sawyer interview, obviously children are not necessarily responsible for the sins of their fathers, but when Diane Sawyer was asking Mel Gibson about his father's Holocaust denial, here's what he said. And again, this was on TV. Tens of millions of people heard this, so just enjoy.
"I think as soon as they started filming, that beacon of journalistic integrity, the New York Times, was, you know, dispatched someone to go down there and take advantage of my father, even before I could finish filming. So, but, you know, do you think they really want to know what my dad has to say, or did they ever want to know before I started making this film? I don't think so. It's a thing to try and drive a wedge in between a man's own flesh and blood. That's my father, okay? I love him. And if they're going to try and drive a wedge in there, it ain't going to happen."
Gibson's father, Hutton Gibson, age 85, who has written books and a newsletter with some decidedly provocative terms of phrase. He has called the Pope, Garrulous Carolus, the Koran kisser. And in that New York Times Magazine interview, he seemed to be questioning the scope of the Holocaust, skeptical that 6 million Jews had died. So what does Gibson think?
"Do I believe that there were concentration camps where defenseless and innocent Jews
died cruelly under the Nazi regime? Of course I do. Absolutely. It was an atrocity of monumental proportion.
And you believe there were millions, 6 million?
Sure.
Millions? I think people wondered if your father's views were your views on this.
Their whole agenda here, my detractors, is to drive a wedge between me and my father. And it's not going to happen. I love him. He's my father.
And you will not speak publicly about him.
I'm tight with him. He's my father. Gotta leave it alone, Diane.
Yeah, but the thing is, you know, Mel Gibson, clearly not as insane as his father. You know, definitely a level-headed guy. He did a Playboy interview in 1995 in which he described Bill Clinton as a low-level opportunist, you know, fair enough, who was telling him what to do. He went on to say that the Rhodes Scholarship was established for young men and women who want to strive for a new world order, which was a campaign for Marxism. He later tried to walk that back. Weirdly, Gibson actually seems like he was critical of the Iraq War, and he praised Michael Moore for Fahrenheit 9/11.
Yeah, well, good for him, I guess. More recently, he's taken a heroic stand against child sex trafficking with his endorsement of Sound of Freedom.
One of the most disturbing problems in our world today is human trafficking, and particularly the trafficking of children. Now, the first step in eradicating this crime is awareness. Go see Sound of Freedom.
Oh yeah, I got something to say about that in a sec, but apparently in 2016, he said that he wasn't voting for Trump or Hillary, and then in 2021, he attended UFC and was filmed offering a salute to Donald Trump. Anyway, to return to Sound of Freedom, I mean, since that was the last movie I saw Jim Caviezel in, the whole time, I just imagined the film as part of the same universe as Sound of Freedom. Caviezel is still playing Tim Ballard there. I was just waiting for after Christ is resurrected and ascends to heaven, the film having the same thing as it does at the end of The Sound of Freedom, where Caviezel's face just fades and you see fucking Ballard's fucking bloated visage staring back at you. So look, I feel like we've given short thrift to the plot in this movie, but the thing is, folks, this film has no plot. That's not just a tongue-in-cheek thing that we're saying. The plot of this movie is that Christ is suffering under the weight of our sins after the Last Supper. He gets arrested. There's some centrist head-scratching about what to do.
Pilate, in trying to avoid this, he says to the crowd, listen, I can release Jesus or I can release Barabbas. And of course, the crowd is, you know, stacked with angry rabbis. So they all say, Barabbas, Barabbas.
Uh-huh. Judas feels some regret. Then he kind of gets harassed by some creatures that look like the Brood from the Cronenberg movie. The devil kind of looks on in various ways. The devil, by the way, looks like they're related to Baron Harkonnen. We spend, I don't know, 5 minutes in Herod's court. Then Jesus gets whipped, condemned, carries the crucifix through the streets, is crucified, is resurrected. Film ends. It's about 2 hours long. It felt like 5 hours. Awful dog shit movie. Terrible.
Regarding the sources, the movie is, of course, based on the New Testament, although apparently it was also based on the visions of two nuns from several hundred years ago. I'm reading Christopher Hitchens' article about the film in Vanity Fair from 2004. He writes, "The first of these women, Mary of Agreda, was a figure in 17th century Spain who wrote that the Jewish culpability for the murder of Jesus, quote, descended to their posterity and even to this day continues to afflict this group with horrible impurities, unquote. The second, Anne Catherine Emmerich, is better known. She was a 19th century German, one of those who brooded for so long and so morbidly on the crucifixion that she claimed to have received the stigmata, the bloody wounds in hands and feet that are for some people the sign of the true devotee. She also told of a vision in which she saved an old Jewish lady from purgatory." So yeah, some odd sources for Gibson's script. Something that I guess has to be reckoned with is the fact that this movie was a genuine cultural phenomenon. It made $370 million at the North American box office, even more worldwide. This being an ultra-violent movie in a dead language. I know that when I saw it, I basically went kind of as a rubbernecker, if anything, or that's too harsh. I mean, it was just the movie that everyone was talking about. Of course, I wanted to see it. And also, I remember going almost kind of in the same way that you'd like watch a horror movie at a slumber party. There'd been all this talk for weeks about how incredibly violent it was. So I remember going into it with this feeling of like, oh my God, like, what's he going to show? Am I going to be able to take it? Like, you know, there was that feeling of anticipation in the air that I think got a lot of people in theaters that weren't necessarily right-wing Christians. It just became this sort of event. It was a different experience seeing it in movie theaters because, you know, you hear that pulsing soundtrack. You hear every flaying, maximum Dolby head smashing clarity. And you see it in that moment of just breathless hype. It's a different experience than watching it now. But even then, like, I can't imagine, you know, this is a movie that seems to preach like so squarely at the choir. I can't imagine how anybody can connect with it if you're not already sold on it. I think of some of the great Christian movies, you know, in Pasolini's The Gospel According to St. Matthew, he's very interested in Jesus as a revolutionary figure. Pasolini famously was a Marxist and wanted to apply that to Jesus. In Scorsese's The Last Temptation of Christ, his big interest seems to be in the idea of someone who is both God and man, somebody with godlike power and goodness also dealing with his own temptations. Not just the temptations of the flesh, but the temptation to not be God, to be a normal man. This isn't a movie that's strictly about Jesus, but it is a Catholic movie. You know, Abel Ferreira's Bad Lieutenant, which is probably my favorite Catholic movie, you know, if I'm creating a canon. Its central idea is if anybody can be forgiven, and if we all should aspire to turn the other cheek and forgive, like, what does that actually look like in practice? The nun in that movie who's raped brutally and then forgives her assailants, you know, without them asking for it, or the Harvey Keitel character in that movie, who's thoroughly reprehensible, thoroughly loathsome. He thinks he's irredeemable, but her doing that act, her forgiving her assailants, makes him think that maybe he could be forgiven. And that leads to a sort of breakdown in him. Like, that's a compelling idea. You know, there are compelling ideas in Catholicism.
Yeah, Martin Scorsese's The Silence, another film. Yeah, brilliant film.
Yeah.
More depth in, like, any single frame of that than in The Passion of the Christ.
And the fundamental idea in this movie is, well, maybe I'm answering my question here. The idea is you will be persecuted for your beliefs and you have to, like Jim Caviezel, stand up after you've been whipped really hard and flex. Like, that's the movie's idea. And I guess to those who find it powerful, that's what they find powerful.
Yeah, a truth that I suspect is especially powerful when you do the I'm definitely not a racist promotional tour Gibson did for this and then get pulled over 2 years later in Malibu.
The loudspeaker spoke up and said, Christianity is stupid. 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 Communism is good. Communism is good.